Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 38 of the Upward Spiral podcast, presented by Hypebot.com. Today on the podcast, we're talking to Maggie Vale, who is the co-executive director of Cache Music, a nonprofit organization that is building both open source tools and an educational curriculum for artists. Previously, she spent 17 years at Kill Rockstars, working in nearly every position at the company before becoming vice president. Maggie was also one of the founding organizers of Ladyfest and has been in dozens of bands over the past several decades. She's joining us today to talk about musicians and labor and how to make sure that artists are paid for their work. I'm Courtney Harding. I develop and manage partnerships at Sounddrop, a social music application for Spotify, web, and iOS devices.
And I'm Kyle Blinn, a user researcher and technology writer at Live Nation Labs, a web and mobile product development group at the company.
And as I said at the top of the show, we are joined by Maggie Vale.
Hi, guys. Thank you both for having me here. I'm really excited.
Thanks for coming. So I guess we should probably start off with a little bit of a, you can give your pitch for what Cache Music is, because some of our listeners might not be familiar with
what you're working on. You did a pretty good job at the start there. We are a nonprofit organization. We build open source digital tools for artists, so everything from download codes to digital sales to email management, that sort of thing. We have a downloadable and a hosted platform, so it's sort of like WordPress on that count. And we are working on educational curriculum to accompany that, because there's a lot of, you know, throwing tools at people isn't really useful if you can't tell them what to do with them, how to use them, best practices, that sort of thing. So look for that in 2014, along with a series of summits designed to bring musicians and technologists together. Because, as you mentioned, I spent 17 years working at an independent record label and discovered over, you know, the course of moving into Cache on sort of the periphery of tech that there wasn't a whole lot of knowledge about what the independent community is and how it can be really healthy for artists. There was just sort of this, like, label is a label is a label is evil. And, you know, that's not the world that I come from. So, you know, I think bringing musicians and technologists together to talk about their realities on both sides, you know, I think that oftentimes there's an us against them sort of mentality, but they have very similar lives. I mean, you know, coding is a very creative activity. So, you know, writing songs, you know, they have entrepreneurs. I mean, they have investors, both of them, you know, they're entrepreneurs. And I think finding that common ground is pretty useful to changing the dialogue about, you know, this future of music.
Cool. So let's kind of dive right into some of the questions and I'll kick off. So, you know, this is not going to come as news to you, but I hear on a really regular basis that all these different arguments about how artists don't need to be compensated, and they hold sorts of different reasons, but they all boil down basically to not seeing art as quote-unquote work.
Right.
So I'm reminded of a quote from an artist that I read a while ago who said, like, being in a band is really fun, but at the end of the day, it's a fun job. Like, you have to show up at the club to play, you have to show up for your interviews, you have, well, unless you're in Death Grips, but for the most part, you have to, like, show up and do things and produce music and do all these ancillary tasks. And it's work.
Yeah.
And, you know, most people would never – actually, Kyle and I got into a little bit of discussion about this, but my feeling is, like, most people, myself included, would not ever think of going into a clothing store and just, like, taking a sweater and being okay with that. Like, that's very clearly shoplifting.
Yeah.
But they have no problem downloading music for free. So my first question, and this is kind of a big one, how do we start to, like, change these perceptions and convince people that creating music is not just, like, a fun little hobby, but it's a form of labor that just, like, paying the guy who mows your lawn, paying the person who makes your music, they should be compensated.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something that, you know, I used to talk to artists about a lot at Kill Rockstars, because I wanted there to be more transparency, and people aren't really necessarily willing to do that. You know, it's like there is some kind of mystery to being in a band that people in bands sort of like to keep. But, you know, I mean, we sort of, I've flirted with the idea a couple of times of, you know, like, what if we actually put down the amount of hours it took you to write your record, record your record, go on tour, do your interviews, you know what I mean? Just break down how much work it is, and how much you're getting paid per hour. You know, I think that if people were to look at it like that on paper, you could maybe begin to have sort of a different relationship to it. But it's just really hard when it's digital. You know, it's really hard when it's not a physical product. Like, you're not going to have people, you know, going into record stores and stealing thousands of records. Like, that's just not going to happen. You're right. It's the physical object. And for some reason, we've reached this, you know, realm where, you know, this sort of esoteric thing isn't of value. And it's a, you
Yeah.
know, it's dangerous.
And I think part of the confusion, at least on the part of the public, has to do with the fact that there are a lot of artists who are like giving away a lot of their music for free, or they're playing free, quote unquote, free shows, which are generally underwritten by, you know, massive brands. But to the public, they're like, oh, everyone's just giving this away. And, you know, I can't really think of any other economic model that involves sort of like weird free paid confusion. I mean, I guess like
I mean, I think
TV.
that there's a real value in doing some of it promotionally. I mean, you know, at Keras, we always saw the free MP3 that we gave away as the most paid for download on iTunes without, like, across the board. It was always the one that was most bought. So there was some promotional value that turned into money. But I think it's really dangerous when you say something like music should always be free, always.
Yeah, and it's like there's always this confusion between the artists, and you're seeing this now with Spotify, which again is not free, but every other week it's like Thom Yorke hates Spotify, but so and so loves it, but so and so another artist hates it. And it's like, if I was just, I mean, I'm, you know, in the industry, so I get a lot more depth, but if I was just an average music fan, I'd be like, well, what the hell? Do I like this? Do I not like this? Is this good? Is this good for artists? Is this not good for artists? Like, you know, there's like no consensus even between artists about who should be paying for what and when and how.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is, you know, like I talked about transparency. There isn't a lot of transparency across the board in the industry. I mean, I think it takes a lot of work to do that sort of transparency. So, you know, say I get a royalty statement from Keras, it doesn't tell me where I sold everything and how much, you know, the digital distributor got or how much blah 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 got. So I think that, you know, there is a lot of unknown, you know, at this point. People are sort of guessing because everyone talks about scaling, right? So, you know, how much money are we going to make if streaming services can scale to this many people, or, you know, which one takes off or whatever. There's so many questions that it's hard to quantify, you know, at this point.
I feel like, you know, Courtney and I are experts, right? We think about these things all the time. And even we run into these sort of situations in our regular lives where we start trying to do the math that supports the idea that we're fans, right? So, like, over 10 years ago, I bought a used Newfound Glory album, Sticks and Stones. It's one of their most famous records so far. And then didn't give the band any more money for another decade until I went to their concert 3 weeks ago. And certainly, you know, I paid $50 for that ticket. I paid another 15 for a beer, and I streamed their brand new album hundreds of times on Spotify and probably will continue to do so for a number of years. But I realized that, you know, this might not actually add up to the actual cost of the album and what it took to bring a bunch of people into the venue and record an album. But, you know, but Newfound Glory themselves, like Courtney was sort of saying earlier, were chanting from the stage. You guys coming to this concert is what allows us to keep doing this business, and we love you guys so much for coming out and supporting us tonight. But I came out 10 years later to support them in the way that they claim to want to be supported. How should I feel about myself in this situation?
I think it's an entirely normal thing to do. You know, I realized the other day that I had bought all my Prince albums secondhand. So I went out and I bought a ton of Prince because I was like, that guy deserves my money. I know he's really rich. He still deserves my money. I love him so much. But you know, I think, right, there's the whole thing of tiers of fans, right? So there's the uber fan and there's the casual fan. And then there's the, you know, even less casual fan or just the listener. So there's only certain tiers of an audience, right, that you can focus on. So there's the ones that are just going to listen to you on Spotify. There's ones that might be interested in seeing a show, and then there's ones that are going to do whatever they can for you. And those are very small, like that top tier is a very small bubble. you know, and it's always going to be a small bubble. But if you were, I mean, and for probably all three of us, we have a ton of bands that we really love, but most of them are going to fall in that middle group too. You know, we're not going to follow everything they do or buy everything they do, but we're going to fall somewhere in the middle of that. And I think that you can feel okay about it. You know, you're making an effort to support them. You're paying attention to what they're doing. You're probably playing them around other people. All that stuff is great. You know, I think that we all can't be uber fans of every band.
Do you think we over-focus on the uber fan these days, though? I mean...
Yeah, of course we do. I mean, because as an artist, if you feel like you're losing any of those, you're losing a huge part of your audience. You know, right? I mean, there's... The uber fans are the ones that keep Kristen Hirsch going. I mean, she's got her subscription service, and there are people that are willing to just pay her to play her music, to do her music. They get access to all the music. They go to shows. You know, they get merch and all that sort of stuff. But that is an uber fan. You know, that's people who are willing to shell out money quarterly to make sure that their favorite artist can do their favorite thing. But that's just a really. That's not everybody. That's never going to be everybody. Never was everybody.
So just to kind of go back and talk a little bit more about this, like, free paid confusion that exists among even people like us.
Right.
How complicit is, like, the industry at large in all this? Because I remember being, you know, in college in 1999 and walking to the Tower Records and paying like $18.99 for a CD. Mm-hmm. Then thinking like, this is not a good value.
Yeah, that was a really terrible idea. CDs have always been incredibly cheap to make, and they totally just went and ripped people off.
So like Napster comes along and I'm psyched. Yeah. I'm like, ooh, free music everywhere. And then, you know, people write off Metallica for suing Napster because, yeah, the dudes in Metallica are rich, but they were also right.
Right.
And the RIAA completely, I mean, they were like, what can we wrong? Let's do it in this instance.
Mm-hmm.
They were awful, but they were fundamentally right. So
right.
Is it too late to go back and repair the damage? Or, like, how do we sort of move forward from this mishandling of everything for the last 15 years?
Well, what I've been really excited to see is that artists are starting to be willing to talk out again. I think after Metallica and Napster, people were terrified to say anything for a really long time. Artists didn't want to come out on the side of, you know, being anti-technology for a long time. There were a few that did, but those were outliers. And I feel like in the last year or two, we've really begun to see people talk, you know, Ed from Grizzly Bear in that article, I can't remember where it was, but he was talking about, you know, basically how they just are extremely middle class, like lower middle class. And you wouldn't necessarily think that of a huge indie band or, you know, Jana from Lower Dens talking about their realities and Damon and Naomi. I mean, I think more and more folks are beginning to speak out about what maybe is next. And that's why you see all these people coming out for and against Spotify. You know, and I think ultimately that streaming conversation is kind of a distraction because streaming is around. It's going to stick around. It's not going to go away. So figuring out a way to make streaming part of the equation rather than just the be-all end-all, I think is a really important conversation. And whether that means, you know, streaming services look to do a little bit more with artists directly, you know, maybe merch sales or whatever. I know that there's a few of them that have talked about that. You know, but making it a piece of the puzzle rather than the be all end all. It's not, you know, it's not necessarily a terribly exciting discussion, but I think it's going to go on for a little bit while.
I think it is an exciting discussion, though, because, you know, I was at the Cash Music Summit, and I talked to someone who's now the director of fan experience at Rhapsody, Jeff, I believe his name was, and he's responsible for thinking about how streaming companies can partner with marketing services, and what they did, right, is they recently partnered with Bandpage that allows them to market their artist experiences to engage fans, a move that's really, you know, it sounds a lot like what we believe might come out of the Beats Music Top Spin media deal. What might developments like this mean for musicians and fans?
I think that it's the first step in the right direction in a long while, to be honest. I think I've heard a few people say here and there, like, I wish there was a way I could tip my favorite artist. And it's kind of insane that that doesn't exist on everybody's website. I mean, frankly, not everybody has a website, which is also kind of insane. But you know, that's the that's the reality. I think it, yeah, I think it's finally a step in the right direction. You know, I would love to see an open version of that. You know, coming from where I come from, and I think that that's entirely possible as well.
Do you think a tip jar is really the answer, though?
No, I don't think it's, I do not think it's the answer. I think that there are a million, I mean, the reality is there's how many disparate, you know, sources of income that you've got to make sure that you know how to collect. And you're, that's not going to go away. You know, there's not going to, we're not going to have album sales the way we used to. I don't think that's ever going to come back. But there's going to be other ways, and there are other ways that people can make money. I think, you know, and a lot of times I focus on that middle class that we had talked about before, like the people who are fans, but not Uber fans. I do think some of those people can be encouraged to buy more records if they felt like they were having this direct interaction with their favorite band. You know, if there was a website, like if every band had a website and was selling something directly, or could tell, you know, or through Rhapsody or through Spotify or whatever streaming service, if there was an offer there for maybe a pre-order bundle with a t-shirt or something, you know, I feel like if these things were a little more prevalent, it might sort of help.
On the previous podcast we hosted, we talked about the idea of forced entrepreneurship in musicians and sort of forced fandom among listeners. And it's this sort of idea that you have these artists who are going to Kickstarter and Pledge Music or the different direct-to-fan marketing services, being entrepreneurs, trying to get their music out there and get listeners interested. But equally on the other end, you have the listener who's hearing from the artists at multitudes of times, I'm sure, saying, "Hey, fund my album, buy my album, share my album, stream my album. Can you do more things with my album?" And I wonder if they too feel a bit overpressured, overwhelmed to be more of a fan than they might be at that time.
And you know, us being in the middle of a Kickstarter campaign, that resonates. You know, I think it's tiresome for everybody to have to keep asking over and over again for money, but I mean, it's part of crowdfunding. Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that's an important one, and one I hadn't thought about.
It seems like the development of streaming music services partnering with these marketing companies reveals this notion that we're accepting that as music becomes abundant, the way to engage these listeners is to offer them scarce products, that making music alone is not enough.
I mean, yeah and no. I think that some of these integrations could be, you know, physical albums or you know, recorded music. They don't necessarily just have to be experiences or ticket sales or you know, rare things. I think that having the option to then buy something directly inside of a platform would be pretty powerful.
I do think so as well. I mean, it is an integration that has never happened before on this level. And I do think making it available definitely has the potential to get uptake in a way that has never happened. I have to wonder though, because like these file sharing services have created such a powerful precedence, right? Like a number of people, friends of mine from back in North Dakota, have asked me over the years, how can I get access to music for free?
Right.
And oftentimes they don't mean that they are seeking paid access to unlimited music. They only want instant access to specific songs. And one would think, YouTube would fill this need, that they'd just be able to play the songs on there and sell their attention through ads and that someone would make money. But what they really want is a mobile download app. And I always feel dumb because I write about tech, but I've never downloaded a single MP3, both through sort of the iTunes model or through the download services. But I also felt smart because I use Pandora and Spotify to play music.
I'm the opposite as you. I don't use streaming services, but I use iTunes a lot.
But it gets to be this conundrum though, right? Because you're trying to tell them, right? It's like, well, I pay money for Pandora and Spotify, And I feel like I'm supporting the music that I like, but at other times, I'm not sure if I'm just seeding money into a bunch of tech companies that are hoping to get acquired. So I'd be curious, Maggie, like, how do you try to explain this situation to like a layman audience, to like your normal friends, where you're trying to say like, hey, just because you listen to music on Pandora and Spotify doesn't necessarily mean your favorite artists are making tons of money, let alone the file sharing side, which is even more nascent and minuscule.
Explaining to people how the music industry works, in a basic way from the from the side of it that I saw is always a really fun eye-opening experience. I mean, I think most people have no clue, all of the different people that can be in the middle of between a transaction. I was explaining this to, oh, who was it? To someone on Saturday, I think, at the Cash Music Summit. And it was somebody who works, in music, but not in the sales side of things. Like it was more promotional, and I was explaining the trail between, oh no, it wasn't. It was an artist. It was an artist that I had worked with who didn't know how it worked. I'm sorry about that. It was someone, talking about like, so when, someone's bought a 99-cent MP3 from iTunes, what does that breakdown look like? And their eyes just got huge. It's just like, oh, right, we only get this tiny, tiny, tiny little bit. But yeah, I mean, I feel like I've had a lot of friends in the last year or so ask me if it's okay to use Spotify, which I think is a really interesting, or other streaming services, not just Spotify. But I think it's a really interesting thing to hear from the from, casual, like people who are outside of the music industry, because I don't think they ask that about anything else. I mean, I don't remember that ever really being asked before. So the fact that it's even kind of on the outside of the periphery of people's minds or whatever is a really interesting thing. And it's different. It's different than anything I've ever seen.
So I wanted to go back to talking about the labor issues a little bit, because I feel like that's really almost the basis for a lot of this conversation. And if we're talking about the artists conceptually, like artists' ability to make a living wage, at the end of the day, who's responsible for that? Like, should we go back to this WPA federal art model where the guys who like painted murals and designed posters were paid by the government? Is there a way for artists to form unions that can at least negotiate touring and sync deals? I mean, like, what are some of the solutions that we can come up with on sort of a bigger picture level to sort of help artists as a community and not just like, oh, here's Kickstarter if you want to fundraise your album, which is like, Kickstarter's a good resource, but it's not like a solution, really.
I mean, the people who do very well on Kickstarter have, generally speaking, already had a label or some sort of industry experience. You don't normally just come out of nowhere and fund your stuff on Kickstarter. You've already gone through, the industry a little bit, so to speak, if you're going to be very successful there. It's an interesting question because I think lots of folks lose sight of the fact that the music industry is based on music, right? So the health of the industry as a whole is really, it lies in the health of, the artists. And I would say currently, that's a really big issue. It's a real problem. They aren't. The folks that I used to work with who are still musicians and still touring, are baffled by how bad touring is. I mean, it's terrible right now. There are so many bands and so many folks competing for attention that people who used to fill much larger halls aren't filling the small ones. And people who are in, sort of major indie bands are feeling the same sort of pain. It's like it's across the board. I think.
Well, and the thing is, everyone comes up with short-term solutions, right? So it's like, okay, your album's not selling, go on tour. Okay, everyone starts touring, market gets flooded. Oh, well, go sell your music to Mountain Dew, and Mountain Dew will pay you a huge pile of money.
And
So
that money gets smaller and smaller all the time.
yeah, because then like the sync market gets flooded, and so no one's talking. Everyone's sort of like finding these short-term solutions,
And you
and
even
no
have the music
one's.
director from Glee talking about how, artists should be paying them for
Yeah. Oh.
syncs. And I knew that somebody was going to say that soon. I really knew that one was coming.
Yeah, but it's like there's no sort of structural fix. It's just all these like short term. And I'm also wondering, are there any Are there solutions out there? Are there good working models and communities that have come up with ways to support artists and make sure they make decent money while also supporting artistic freedom? I mean, I'm sure in some countries, some despot ruler is like, yeah, artists, I'll pay you a living wage and you have to write songs about how great I am and clearly
right.
that. Like, are there solutions that you've seen where governments are supporting the arts and people are, and artists are thriving?
Right. I mean, that happens more in other countries, right? In places like France, there was a, and in New Zealand as well, and Australia, I know all the people that do those, that sort of job, like sort of cultural affair jobs, but they get their artists touring, the US. And I remember in France in particular, there was a band that this woman wanted me to sign, and they were like, the government was going to pay for them to come over here and tour, but oftentimes that money comes from money that they're not giving American artists, which is crazy. I didn't even know that until I lobbied Congress with Music First, but they were talking about how because the U.S. doesn't pay performing rights royalty on radio, there's no reciprocity. So, when Europe collects that, it doesn't go to the American bands. They keep it and put it back into their own system and put it back into their artists. I don't know if that's actually true, but somebody told me that there.
I mean, I would believe that.
I guess I should say a disclaimer. Like, I don't. I guess someone just told me that. I didn't actually look it up or anything. So.
So to sort of, draw all this out even further, how much of a decline in people seeing artists as people who should be compensated as part of an overall decline in people seeing, like, other people as needing to be compensated?
Right.
And I mean, there's been, like, these big backlashes against raising the minimum wage, even though mm-hmm. lots of studies show it would have almost no negative impact. There's also a rise of this perma-intern culture where kids in their 20s are just expected to work for free.
Right.
Like, they're not expected to get even low-paying work your way up jobs. It's just like, I have kids working for me right now that are paid interns, but they're mm-hmm. still hopping from paid internship, and they're in their mid-20s. And it seems like the general public, over the course of the last, 40 or 50 years, has had a hard time thinking that most people should be paid fairly unless they're, like,
right.
bankers, I guess.
Yeah, and it's a terrifying mindset. It really is. Because I feel like there's just this celebration of entrepreneurs, which is a great thing. Entrepreneurship is really important, but I feel like it comes at the expense of, there's this, that whole bubble of, I'm going to come up with this idea, whether or not people need it, I'm going to get it funded and try to make a million. It's like everyone trying to win the lottery or something. And there isn't a lot of focus on craftsmanship, whether that's, playing music or making chairs or, like, there isn't sort of, music is a trade in a lot of ways. It's a craft, but it's also a trade. And I think there isn't a lot of focus just in our culture in general, towards that.
I was reading an article earlier today that sort of talked about the idea that young musicians are too eager to share their creative works, that they're not putting in enough time to get enough experience to make something truly worth hearing. They have
right.
this share button in front of them, and they're too tantalized by the idea of, like, getting the instant gratification and feedback of distributing it throughout those audiences,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's that sort of bias of the medium, too.
Right, right. Well, and that's also just a deeper industry-wide problem. I mean, in the 20 years that I've worked in the music industry, it's clear that there's less and less time into development, and there's less and less money and time available for artists to develop. And that comes down all the way to what you're saying, to people like who are just sitting in front of a computer and putting up whatever they just did, which is something I totally did recently. It's embarrassing. But, I think, yeah. I just lost my train of thought. I'm so sorry.
another thing we talked about on the last podcast was this idea that, there's numerous crowdsourcing music platforms.
Right.
Or no, that's what it is. It's collaborative platforms that enable musicians to upload their work and get feedback from other musicians as well as work
right,
with them
stuff, yeah.
and get the sort of real-time feedback from fans. Do you think that other artists and fans could ever supplement the kind of feedback that you could get from, maybe a music industry professional like yourself at a record label.
Right. I think that those services are strange, to be honest. I worked at a record label and with did A&R for the last 9 years, I think I was at Kill Rock Stars. I don't think I ever told anybody what to sound like. I didn't think it was my job. I would give people feedback if they had questions for me, but I would never, ever, ever presume to know what they should do with their art. So I find that conversation and those particular platforms to be a little odd. But I also come from a very particular moment in time, I think, in the music industry. I think I have a pretty unique perspective, working at an independent label in the 90s.
There was another great article by Chuck Klosterman. I think it came out roughly last year or the year before that. He was writing about the Lou Reed Metallica collaboration. And what he essentially argued is that this is what happens when musicians make too much money, don't have the commercial record industry staring down their throats, and that the album was horrible, right? Like, it was horrible on its face, it wasn't any good. And that as much as Metallica was against the man in their career and made sure that the man didn't sort of shape their sound, so many men are responsible for the sound that Metallica is. And the reason why people want it is because it has gone through that lens of the music industry and the feedback that made it more commercial, whether that was through, the rise of their sort of more metal sound in the early days, or the different sort of forces that came together to form the Black Album, right? Like, they were so accused for selling out, and then they sold out venues for the next 2 decades. So how do we, in this discussion of like, artists looking to get compensated for their art versus professional musicians looking to get compensated for their product, I mean, should there be a distinction there? I mean, how should we think about that relationship?
It's funny because I see so often when people are talking about, or when people are complaining about artists wanting to get paid, they use the term art, right? They say, you shouldn't want to be paid for your art. It taints the art. But so often those people are also working inside the music industry or inside a tech company around the music industry. And I think, wait a second, how are we all getting paid? It's like, why is it just a commodity or content when it comes to your paycheck, but when it comes to an individual, it's art. I think for better or worse, we live in an era where there's recorded music and there's been an industry around it. It's an art and it's a commodity. I think, you can either choose to take part in that as an artist or not. There's ways you can do it that are a little bit less crummy than others. You don't have to be greedy or blatant. You can create community. You can create change. You can do different things with your art. But ultimately, it is a commodity, and there is a sale in there, as well as there being art. It's difficult. It's always been difficult. Living in the 90s in Olympia, Washington, really set me up, I think, for this. This sort of day and age. We had these conversations then, when people were buying records. It's interesting.
It feels like this, this whole conversation about, what is work, what is labor, what should we get compensated for, can be fairly meta if we wanted to, right? Like, Courtney and I are making a podcast that we are paid $0 to produce. You are paid $0 to appear in the podcast. Listeners are paying $0 to hear it. And you work at a company that pays $0, it's a nonprofit, but you're hoping to raise money so that you can have the money to do this work, right? But what we're doing does produce real value and it costs real money. And if you want to get even more meta, there's a guy somewhere right now that has a patent on this thing that we now call podcasting, who claims to have invented podcasting, who is suing people and hoping that they'll pay him a licensing fee to be able to podcast, because he, the lonely inventor artist, took a risk on various ventures, one of which was audiobooks on tape, your favorite experts reading your curated magazine articles. And it did not work out. But he wants to get paid now too because he invested the money, and now all of the technology that all of the wonderful companies invented are using his idea, right? So, you know, the buzzword bingo is pretty incredible if you think about it, right? Personal branding and platform building and the attention economy combined with curated conversations with thought leaders like yourself who run a not-for-profit company that distributes free open-source tools for musicians. And all of this with the scary patent trolls and massive lawsuits and, you know, obviously this isn't a going concern now, but it's a growing one today. And I guess, you know, what I'm getting at is that this whole thing, adulthood, professional life, is really complicated if you think about it. And how do we explain such mental gymnastics to artists and coworkers when we ourselves are gymnasts?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a difficult one. I mean, I think, you know, the reason why I do cash, the reason why we exist, is we don't know that there is one single answer to any of this, that we're all going to be doing gymnastics for a long time trying to figure it out. But the very least of what we can do is give basic technology for free, you know, give access to that for free. So the very minimum amount of things that you know, need to do for your internet presence are going to be there. It's not ever going to be locked behind, you know, it's never going to be a freemium thing. It's always going to be free. It'll work with other services. The code lives on, even if the organization doesn't. You know, we feel very passionately that we can do a handful of things that will allow people to build on top of that. You know, I don't think Jesse or I ever pretend to have the answers. And that's why we continue to keep pushing and keep pushing these questions. You know, that's why we want to have these summits. That's why we want to get musicians and technologists together, because we want people to come up with what works for them. You know, that's one of the things about the music industry, too, is that there was never one magic bullet anyways. You know, there was never one way to market an album. There was never one way to make a band huge. It's always been a different path every single time. Every single time I've had a good, you know, a record that did fairly well, it didn't follow the same path as the one before. You know, so it's harder. I don't know that it's entirely different than it's always been.
I think this really brings us to something I'd like to talk about more, which is like the discussion around the middle class musician, right? I mean, this race has been around for a number of years now.
Yeah, I told Jesse today we should stop calling them middle class musicians and calling them working class musicians. Because it's not like the American middle class. It's way more working class, the monetary reality.
You just stole my next line, which is that we don't have a consistent definition for what this means, or even a reliable framework as to how someone might get there. Like you said, it, you know, none of these successes are replicatable in the way that they came into fruition. There's things to learn, but there's not clear paths to follow. And like you said, we're trying to establish not just a middle class musician, but a middle working class musician. Like, this is hard work. And I just kind of wonder, like, and I'd love for you to expand on this. What does it mean to be a middle-class working musician today, and is this livelihood attainable?
I think it is attainable. I mean, I know a few of my friends around me that I would say have that sort of freedom. And so how I would define a working-class musician or successful working-class musician is someone that doesn't have to do anything else, right? So all they do is music. They don't have a day job. They don't come home and work at a coffee shop. They're able to come home and, you know, maybe take a few weeks off and write some new songs or whatever. You know, I'm in a band with two-thirds of the Thermals. This is who I'm thinking of right now. They are successful working class musicians. You know, they put out an album probably, every year and a half or so. They go on their album cycle touring, which lasts about a year. They do all of their own mail order. They they do all of that hard work themselves, but they're working class musicians. They're successful at it because they don't have to have any other supplemental income. I think they get a couple of licenses a year. They don't do ads, but they do, film and TV syncs, and they get those. It's possible. It's not easy. I see how much work they do. And in cases like touring is a funny thing, right? Because in the music industry, what do you get for free consistently, even no matter how bad you are? You get drinks. You might be the opening band and you might not even get any money that night, but you're going to get a couple of drink tickets, right? So touring in and of itself is a whole can of worms. I used to see my friends in Olympia that would go out on tour and come back, and they would have a hard time not drinking every day. I saw a lot of those people. A lot of them are sober now. It's you have to drive all night all the time. People are always hitting deers or black ice, or there's accidents. Look at Lelouz on, Hardly Art. They just totaled their van, and thankfully we're fine, but just trying to get home from a show. And musicians don't live very long, right? Like, think about the Ramones. I think about that all the time because they toured in a van. They never upgraded to a bus. They really just did it the hard way for their whole
Yeah,
career.
people seem to have this romantic fantasy about going on tour. And then, like, I went on tour with my friend's band for a few days, and it sucked. It's so hard.
I
You're
had a
sleeping.
really fun time in my 20s, but it would be hard to get me back in a van, I think. I probably will in the next year, which will be totally fascinating because I haven't toured in 10 years. But yeah, it's brutal. It's this weird thing where we used to call it a 24-hour family in bangs. Where you get really intimate with everybody, and there's no way around it. And parts of that are wonderful, and parts of it are terrible.
And it's kind of the worst way to destroy your health. I mean, think it's like being a touring artist is like being a long distance trucker. And again, it brings me back to this point of like, no one would ever say like, oh, long distance truckers shouldn't get paid, or long distance trucking is easy. Like no, you would think I was smoking crack, like across the board.
And then there are people right now, if they heard us, when they hear us speaking, will sort of laugh that we think it's comparable, or that musicians are ever worth it. That somehow, just by virtue of getting to go on tour or put out an album, they have gotten their compensation,
Yeah, but that's bizarre to have this concept that like, oh, you drive all the time through the night under stressful deadlines because you have to be somewhere, and if you're doing it to deliver Chinese toys to Walmart, then you deserve a living wage in a union. And if you're doing it to play music for people, then like shut up and get in the van and take your drink tickets and go away because you're having quote unquote fun.
Which is also strange because if you think about what music means to us, right? It's everything. It's entirely different than a Chinese toy for, at Walmart. Like, music is such a different commodity. It's so much more meaningful to people. Think about, we always joke about doing a campaign of a day without music, right? So you show people watching a movie with no music. Like, some of those scenes are really awkward without the music. Especially horror movies. Or, somebody had like some kind of driving to work and stuck in traffic and, just dead silence. Or a coffee shop. How awkward is that when you walk into one? It's everywhere. It's everywhere all the time. It's through all of our rituals. And it's all of our daily lives. Like, you're not going to have a funeral or a wedding without music. And so it's such a different sort of commodity. And I think some of that leads to this strange idea about the people who are laboring doing it, but I think it's backwards. It's just, yeah, I can't, it's so hard, right? It's like a needle in a haystack, just trying to, like, where did all of this come from? I mean, like you said about talking about the CDs, the music industry in some ways totally did this to themselves. You hear the stories back back to the beginning of recorded music with blues musicians being ripped off, you know, and it's, you go through the 60s and you hear about all these bands and these terrible stories, like Badfinger, worst story ever, you know, you just hear these horrible, horrible stories about how managers and publishers and labels ripped them off.
Yeah, and the Badfinger example is actually, I mean, it's a terrible story, but it's funny now because it was the song that ended Breaking Bad. And right. I went on Twitter the next day and like everyone was tweeting about it. And there were a lot of people like, oh, Badfinger reunion tour coming up? And
oh,
I was like,
God.
I was like, yeah, they're all dead.
Probably not. Yeah, it's terrible. You know, but I feel like the, you know, the overwhelming story behind the music or whatever, there's always, it's always this story of being ripped off. And so there's no faith in the industry as a whole, as a fan or as an audience. And so how do you change that as well?
Maggie, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your thoughts. If people want to look you up online, where can they find you and Cash Music?
Cashmusic.org, or, you know, Twitter, we're at Cash Music.
And how about you personally?
I am Magic Beans at Twitter.
That's all for this episode of the Upward Spiral podcast. Thanks to Hypebot.com for helping to put this podcast out. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at upwardspiralpodcast@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at upwardspiralpod. And don't forget to subscribe in iTunes. Thank you for listening.